There. That's new.
They're watching us.
I want to figure out. They say there's this feature where it'll make it look like we're all around the same table. But I haven't figured out how to do that yet.
Oh.
Make it look, they're all sitting
at
the table.
Yeah.
So let's get into Matthew 5, the Beatitudes. And I wanted to make a point as a general point about the book that is becoming more clear as we're reading it. Matthew, more than the other gospel writers, really brings out this theme of Jesus's teaching being something about not just doing something, but doing it correctly from the heart. The heart is something that, Matthew writes a lot about. It's in Matthew that we're going to hear, you know, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, and talk about the outward behavior versus the inward disposition. So it's always goodness from the heart that Matthew is going to bring out in the teaching of Jesus. I don't think we made that point before, but I want you to keep that in the back of your mind as you start to hear the teaching. Of course, we're in the Sermon on the Mount. We're in Matthew 5. We have two more chapters of the sermon to go through. But keep that in mind as you hear his teaching as really, you know, an important point. Again, nothing really is new in Jesus's teaching. He does highlight certain things, not so much versus old teachings, but of bad interpretations of old teachings. I'll give you an example that will come up way down the road. Well, actually, several times it will come up. Almost every time Jesus does a healing in Matthew, or in actually any of the Gospels, what day does it happen to be? What's the thing to guess?
Sabbath.
Sunday.
There you go. Okay, and they get mad at him. Why are they mad at him?
It's not Sunday, it's Sabbath.
Because it's Sabbath. Like working.
Right.
Like working on Sunday.
Exactly. Whoop, hold on a second. I'm trying to get the chat room off and I closed everything. Let's see. Hold on just a second. I was monkeying this at the wrong thing. There we go. Okay. Yeah, so why is it significant that he does it on the Sabbath? And what does he say about it?
Rick, he supersedes the law. What is that, Rick, that expression? That I came to fulfill the law, not to, what is it, Rick? That
didn't come to obliterate the law, came to fulfill the law.
Right. In other words, he didn't change the law.
Right.
Right.
What he is showing is what the law was, what they were supposed to have learned from the law that they didn't. They learned the wrong thing. And so a lot of when Matthew addresses, in Matthew, when Jesus addresses the heart, that's really what you're going to see is not so much a superseding or a destruction of the law. It's actually how they misinterpreted the law and that Jesus is now going to correct.
So Father, when you say, you know, the heart, it's so Jesus is getting to the heart of the law, and you think the others were...
letter
more the let what we call like the letter, or others would say the a juridical, or am I saying that word right, you know?
Yeah.
Go
ahead, sorry.
But some would argue that there is this stringent rule in even in Orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, why they argue against organized religion and so on. I think they miss the heart of the law.
Yes.
And all they see are the requirements and demands, maybe, of the law. And maybe Jesus is, you're saying, telling us to look at this so differently.
Yeah. He's always going to talk about not just what something looks like. Or not just what, you know, an example, to fulfill the law. I mean, we're going to hear about the Pharisee and the publican. That'll be one of the parables. It's not just about an outward fulfillment. So even in people that argue, you brought the issue of Orthodoxy, people that argue with us from outside the community would say, you have all of these obligations, you have all these rules. Bishop Anthony and another priest, when they had their musical group Kerygma, so you remember that?
Yes.
A lot of contemporary songs. One of the first lines of one of their songs, if I remember right, is they say all we have is obligations, all kinds of rules and regulations. Mm-hmm. And then it goes on to talk about the beauty of the church. In other words, if we think that all those rules are the end and not the means, we're going to misunderstand them.
Mm-hmm.
The rules are always there for an inner change, an inner transformation. And this is the hardest thing, not only for people outside the church to understand, even inside. When we run across something we don't like, we often argue it on the externals.
Mm.
And one of the things that I have to do probably every day is try to help someone understand, just because the church says this, it's not just for the reason of fulfilling the law. There's a deeper meaning. I'll give you an example. We always say that a regular confession is a requirement of communion.
Yeah.
Or a preparation for.
Yeah.
Now, the people that don't want to come to confession, we all don't want to come to confession to some level, but the ones that don't want to come at all would say, why do I have to, you know, say my sins to the priest, come to the church, whatever. They'll talk about an outward manifestation of the requirement.
Yeah.
But what's really going on, the requirement isn't a rule so much as it is saying, if you're going to commune with God and with everyone else, with the whole creation, you really have to be as prepared as you can by turning from your sin, which is the false God of our lives. All of our sins are sort of false gods that we serve that we think are getting us something good, they don't, and turning toward God. So from the inner perspective, it's the same thing. Like, why wouldn't you come to confession at some point regularly before you're taking communion? But when we focus on the outward manifestation, that's when you miss it. You miss the whole point. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention before I forget that somebody told me that Bishop's brother,
Craig,
said that of his brother, the bishop, leads with his heart.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's true. And he's one who, like all bishops, are very traditional. He's not here to change the faith, but he understands that the heart is, it's where everything happens that's important. It doesn't mean the outside expression isn't important. It is. But it's important because it's the manifestation of what's going on in the heart. Bishop Anthony talks a lot about the push within Orthodoxy with lots of good reasons, but for more of an external change with not necessarily an internal conversion. So... Oh. That's sort of one of the reasons, one of the things that he keeps an eye on. Because it's, let's face it, it's easier to act like something than actually change from within.
Right.
And so in Matthew, we're going to see this very clearly, that Jesus is about the transformation of people all the way through, not just acting in a certain way. And that was, at least for his time, his criticism of the Jews, especially the Pharisees. I mean, think about it. We even use that term, somebody's acting Pharisaical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even if you don't know the Bible, people know that means you're acting one way, but you're not really doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so keep that in mind as we continue through Matthew, especially as we go through the Sermon on the Mount. We talked about, blessed are the pure in heart. It wasn't just pure in heart, pure from the center. Pure from the core.
Yeah.
Or did we talk about that? Maybe not. Maybe that's what we were going to talk about. Let's see where we are. We talked about that, right? Okay.
Blessed are the pure in
heart. Oh, that's right. Because we did verse 9 last week. If you were not here last week, you missed Matthew 5, verse 9.
Blessed are the peacemakers.
What a good discussion we had. It was really good.
Yeah.
All right.
The Father.
Yeah.
I know this puts you on the spot, and it certainly puts us on the spot.
Uh-oh.
But you look at our church. We'll just look at our church and ask, are we external or are we internal at this point in our life as a church? And I'm talking as a whole. I'm not talking about individuals, because there are individuals who will be external and there are individuals who will be deeply internal. And so as a priest, you get a sense of where we are. And I'm sure that some priests will feel that there's a great deal of external in their church. And there might be some priests who feel there is a real depth of internal. And it's a spectrum, obviously. So
yeah.
What's your sense about us, Father? And, you know, I know what you feel your mission is, what you're told your mission is, you know, as a priest and so on. But, and I know that churches can disappoint priests, you know, too. And maybe some priests can disappoint some churches, but where do you see us at St. Nick? Maybe I would ask.
We're always, you mentioned the word spectrum. That's a perfect way. We're always on that spectrum, not just as a church, but all of us as people. In other words, none of us are purely doing it externally. And no one's doing it purely for the most pure reasons from the inside. We're all somewhere in there. And I will confess to you a realization that I had that illustrates this. In the Matin service, the way Matins is organized, I won't get into all the details why this is, but every service has what are called the quiet prayers, or the silent prayers. They're the prayers that you typically don't hear the priest doing.
Yeah.
Now, I tend to do them loud enough that if somebody wanted to listen, they could probably hear, especially on a live stream. So you guys have mentioned you hear them more often.
Right.
In Matins, the way that works is there are 12 silent prayers. And the way the priest prays them is while the six psalms are being read at the beginning of Matins, the priest prays those 12 prayers all together.
Uh-huh.
He does the first, while the first three psalms are being read, he does them at the altar. And then he comes out for during the second three of the six psalms, he does them before the icon of Christ.
Uh-huh.
Again, I won't get into all the details of why that is and what it all means. But I'll tell you this, when I am in front of the icon,
mm-hmm.
I pray with more concentration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is that? The first part when I'm in during the first three, I'm before the altar. If there was a motivation to pray more purely, it would be closer to the altar.
Right.
So why is it when I come out, I'm more focused? And the reason is because I know I'm being watched.
Right.
There's an external motivation for me to focus more internally. Now, I'm not saying to you that I'm faking it. I'm not faking it. What I'm saying to you is I'm praying more sincerely that second half.
Yeah.
But what's motivating is I know I'm being watched.
Yeah.
That's my
I agree. That's what I was going to say. You're looking at Christ and he's listening to you. Right. He's watching.
Not just watched by him, though.
Alan, I mean, watched by you. Watched by you and me. That's what he's saying.
Exactly.
So, Father, that brings up a point I have a little problem with for myself, that sometimes, especially if I'm sitting up closer, you feel like you got to be sure you're standing and sitting and kneeling, you know, when it's past Pentecost, and that you're blessing yourself at the right time and you're doing it all right.
Yep.
And so there's an awareness sometimes when you're, and yet I love sitting up close because my focus can be right on you and on the altar and on the icons. Whereas the further back, you can't help but to focus on all the people.
That's why Alan's in front.
Susie, I have to interject here because I've told Father this many times. When I go to Matins, I'm sitting right in that first row closest to him. And when he does come out and say those prayers in front of the icon of Jesus, I've already said my prayers in front of the icon of the Theotokos. And I will look at him and I think to myself, Father's praying. I've already prayed. Please, St. Mary, ask your son to hear my prayers. And for some reason in my head, I think because he's praying, my prayers are going to go faster. And it really is. He's concentrating so hard and I'm concentrating on him. It is a special time, and it's special to be up there before we have to go sing and we're doing something else. We're still participating, but that's my quiet time to say my prayers.
Wow. Yeah.
That's good.
So I'll have to say that internal external is always going to be a struggle. We're always going to want to default to the easier. It's always easier to act in the sense of like something's going on rather than have that internal change. And so to answer your question, we're all on that scale. A priest, I think when we're at our best, we're not disappointed with our parishes. We want more. It's kind of like you are with your kids. You don't get disappointed in your kids at your best moments. You want more for them. It's not that they've let you down. It's what you want for them, right? So a priest as a father feels the same way about his flock, about his community. He wants more for them, not just from them. And I'll be honest, it's the struggle for me as a priest, probably for all of my brother priests in a similar way. We can get the external response easier than the internal.
Sure.
But we know that that's not the goal.
Right.
In other words, I could preach guilt and out of guilt get better response, at least outwardly. But that's not the goal. Why? Because I read Matthew. So while I think I have to bring out things that may engender guilt, I also have to push people to go past your guilt to what guilt is there to do, which is to push you to the internal change. You know, think about it. Guilt is not a behavior. Guilt is an internal disposition that isn't resolved by some kind of outward expression. You're absolved from your guilt when you change on the inside, right? So that's the goal, is that all of us are being changed. And again, that wasn't new. If you look at the Old Testament, look at the Psalms. Create in me a clean heart, O God. Mm-hmm. I renew a right spirit within me. Mm-hmm. But it's not different. What Jesus is going to do, though, is he's going to correct any misconception from the law. And he's going to correct, especially the Pharisees, because they were the teachers of the law. He's going to say, do what they tell you to do, but don't act like them because they're hypocrites.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that answers your question, but we're all on that journey. We're all trying to push it, hopefully, to be a deeper and deeper reality. And again, go ahead, Rick.
The ladder of St. John Divine.
Yes. Very few behaviors on there,
right?
You know, renunciation, that you don't see renunciation, you choose it as an attitude. You say, I'm going to live not tied to this world, I'm going to live as I'm on this journey of exile from this world into the kingdom. So, yeah, it's all, but it, and when you get the internal right, the external will always follow. But the opposite is not the case.
Interesting.
Exactly.
I think what we're fighting also, Suze, is in our modern orthodoxy, and I would say more for the older adults, we were taught in a way that taught the externals, go to church, don't cross your legs in the pews, you know, do these things. But the people teaching us didn't always understand the internals, even our clergy. I've mentioned this before, I'll say it again. I'm only the second generation in the modern era where education of the clergy is the standard.
Right.
Right.
So those other priests, didn't mean they were worse priests, doesn't mean that they were not as effective. They were more effective in many, many ways. They did miraculous things, especially consider that they didn't have education.
Right.
So what did they do? They could teach the externals, and thank God they did, because it helped keep things going until we could, you know, get those understanding better. But that's where those of us that learn under that system, we're sort of programmed for the external, for all good motivation. But now God is giving us the blessing of understanding why. You know?
Yeah.
And yet,
you can't. Well, Jen asked the question, have you heard it? Can you teach the internal? Jesus is going to say yes. Jesus is going to say, teach the internal and you'll get the external.
Amen.
Because the Pharisees taught the external and then themselves weren't doing the internal.
Right.
And what do you do? They're hypocrites. They're fakers.
But we can teach that we need to look at the internal. Is it something you learn?
I can't hear you.
We're missing.
Now I forgot what I was saying. But can we teach the internal? Is it something you learn? Is it something you can be taught?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it can, but
can you teach somebody to teach?
It's much, you got to really see what Jesus does, and we'll watch this throughout the gospel. He's giving us the instruction here, but he's not saying, do this. Remember, we said that the law in the Old Testament was, thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt. Now he's saying, blessed are those who.
Yeah.
And then later on when he tells his parables, it's not going to be clear to everybody what's the point of the story. And only to the disciples will he reveal the full truth. He'll say, a woman went out, or a woman lost a coin in her house, and she swept the whole house until she found that lost coin.
Yeah.
Again, I will say, the kingdom of heaven is like a man who finds a pearl of great price in the field, and he sells everything he can to buy the field. So he's going to set up the possibility to adopt that inner, but he's not going to say, here's what you do. Very, very rarely is Jesus going to say, do this. He'll say, when you do this, like, for example, we get to the next chapter, he's going to say, when you pray, when you fast, when you give alms, the assumption is we're doing it.
Yeah.
Then he's going to tell us how, or specifically how not to do it. And you can see there that sort of don't, it's not just the doing it. So yeah, to teach it, it's not going to be very direct. It's sort of like you're going to see him sort of tilling the garden and letting things grow. It's a very, Jesus taught in a very different way than any teacher ever taught.
So is it possible that those generations of priests that didn't get education?
Could you speak up, please?
Sorry, I'm saying, is it possible that the generations of priests that didn't get education still had the heart and knew what they would do
Yes.
without the education? I guess that's
so they had the heart. Did they know the details? No.
Right.
But you can't tell me that there wasn't a lot of saintliness going on
Yeah.
among those people who maybe even more so because they didn't know.
Right.
They just believed.
They just
trusted.
Just what we did.
Yeah. Right.
And maybe
I think
that's okay.
Yeah.
See, but yeah, the thing that strikes me about Jesus and what he was, how he taught, it's so so much bigger than our comprehension. But yet he was able to use examples like pointing to children and saying, unless you become like one of these, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven.
Right.
So when you think of the innocence of children and you think of the attitude of children and how open they are to Christ. You know, when I think of my little grandson, Ryan, and I show him an icon of Jesus and I say, that's Jesus. And he knows Jesus. And he was asked by his mother, where's Jesus? And he puts his hand on his heart. Mm. You know, this is a 3-year-old child.
Right.
And how does he know that? Right. It's just, it's, and that's the kind of faith that Jesus wants us to attain.
Yes.
So what Father is saying, and what I've often thought, is that, and believe me, Father, there's nothing like education. There's nothing like attending these classes and these studies and getting deeper into the word and understanding it. Mm-hmm. But there's this expression, blind faith, as if we, you know, can blindly accept. But what they didn't understand externally, meaning maybe our grandparents, they somehow understood internally.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep.
And I wonder if their faith was not more, and I'm not looking for judgmentalism on this spectrum, Father. Yep. But I wonder if their faith was deeper because they weren't caught up with all the trappings of external. They knew when to stand, sit, and kneel and bless themselves better than us.
Yeah.
But sometimes you just cut through the clutter and your heart accepts what your mind maybe doesn't understand.
Right.
Do you think?
Absolutely. And the difficulty now is not that we're better because we have more education.
Right. The
difficulty is we're raised in this time that if you can't explain it, it really isn't real.
Exactly. So, and that's why orthodoxy is so good. We don't have an explanation for everything. We say it's a mystery.
Right. But our assumption, because every other aspect of our life, we have so much capability that when we get to the area of faith, if we don't feel we have the explanation, there's a sense in us that we're incomplete. Now, that's not true, because it wasn't true that a generation or two generations ago, they had less faith. I think they had more because, in spite of not understanding and with a lot more difficulty, they did amazing things.
Right.
But the problem is not so much the change in the people in the church, it's the change in the people and the whole world that says, if you're not educated, you don't get this. I've probably used this example before, but so forgive me if I have, but it's a perfect one. A woman in the parish in Bowling Green, she was advanced in years, a very healthy, very dynamic person. Really was very important in the growth of that community in Kentucky. One of the founders, and without her, that church wouldn't be there. She would always tell me, "Oh, Father, I wish I understood our faith like the converts do." And I said to her, I can't tell you how many times, it's wonderful they understand certain things that they do. It's wonderful that they've read things and it brought them closer to church. But I'd say to her, you don't understand how much you know in your heart that maybe you can't explain all the reasons and the theology and the history, but you know it. Mm. I said, that's what these converts are seeking. And even after they've converted, most of them haven't found it yet because they're still in the framework of, I have to understand it. I have to master it in my understanding. And then I can put it, I said, you just do it. And that's, you do it from your heart. So yeah, there is that sense of you can't teach it, but you got to prepare the ground for it. It's actually what we're trying to do with our kids right now, because with our youth, who we know are susceptible to all kinds of temptations to take them away from the church.
Yeah.
They have this temptation of if it can't be explained to me, it's not worthwhile. It's not true. And we're trying to, instead of what we did for a couple of generations is, all right, we'll give you a lot of facts. We'll give you history, theology, and all that's great. But what we didn't do, and you know, with all our good intentions, we didn't always understand how to reach the heart. So now we're saying, okay, the topics are good, the information is good. Let's teach from the heart. And there's different ways we're trying this now. It's a very difficult time for people to understand the normalcy of faith, Let's put it that way. I mean, faith is a normal thing.
He said about the converts and the ones that live at the lady at your old church. We need each other, the converts and the ones that are living. We complement one another.
Absolutely.
And that's why we need the like Orthodoxy 101 that I think we're doing, and I've taken three times because we missed a lot growing up, the book learning.
Yeah.
But if they're getting bogged down in it, we still can learn from them and they can learn from us. We need each other.
Yeah. And Susie, you asked about how I look at the parish. That's one of our great strengths here, is we have a strong, let's say, founding families, older families, whatever you want to call them. There's a strong foundation. And in a lot of churches, that community isn't strong. They're there Sunday mornings and that's it.
Uh-huh.
Our community, they're strong throughout. That community does come to midweek services. They do come to Bible studies. But we also have a growing strength among our convert community that does sort of bring in the rest of us a little more interest to understand. And they, so yeah, you're absolutely right. They're really helpful to each other.
I think the kids today that have exposure to things like camps, whether they be Greek or Russian or Antiochian, or whether they're at wherever they're located, I think the camps help them understand from the heart versus the facts. I can see that in kids that have exposure to camps versus kids that haven't been to a camp, so to speak.
Yeah, and there's so many levels to that. There's the modeling of the counselors of good Christian life that is fun and attractive. It's not boring and old and outdated. They're seeing young adults that are excited about learning about their faith. They're seeing a liturgical experience that's exactly the same in content as what they see at home, but the experience is now you have the community because we sing all the services together at the village. And at the other camps. So they feel something that you can learn out of a book. When you say, okay, the early church, everyone's saying most of the service. That's a nice idea. What does it mean? It doesn't mean much of anything until you experience it. Then, like Alan's saying, from the heart, you go, wow, liturgy really is the work of the people. I mean, I could talk for an hour about the meaning of the word liturgy, and I would bore them all asleep. But when they go into a service of the village and everyone's singing together, there is a power that you cannot describe and analyze that they experience. And now I think you're right. And that what's experience? Experience is what your heart touches. It's not just what your eyes see and your ears hear. It touches your heart. But it's not emotional. I'm always going to caution this. Susie will bring this out, that I bring this out a lot. The heart is not the core of our emotions. Because here's how the modern thinkers think. You think with your mind and you feel with your heart. Right? Is that an assumption? Is that a safe assumption to make?
Sure.
Right.
Okay. But your feelings, and I think did we talk about this here or is that another gathering?
No, for years, Father.
Okay, so I'm not going to go into all this in the depth. The feeling is that physical reaction to the thought. In other words, if all you have are your thoughts and your feelings, you still haven't gotten to the heart. Because the heart is where, as Jesus is going to teach us, that's where God lives. That's where you encounter him. That's where you are the most you. And as we sin with our senses, that sin infiltrates the heart. And what he's going to say is, don't just not sin with your senses, your touch, your sight, all this. You gotta fast, from sin, from your heart. And we'll see this very soon. What he's gonna say, you have heard it said this, but I tell you. You heard it said, you should not commit adultery. But I tell you, he who looks at a woman lustfully has committed adultery. Somebody finish the verse.
In his heart.
There you go.
Thank you, Jimmy Carter.
So that's not feeling. That's why I'm saying, be careful of the feelings. The feelings are maybe a little deeper than the thoughts, but they're a reaction to the thoughts. We got to keep going. This is where, again, modern Christianity has put so much focus on the feeling and isn't saying how to go below that, how to get deeper than the feeling. Because the modern sense is that's the closest I have to my heart. Watch commercials.
Father, this is really difficult to process because I think we've all, and I hope everyone will agree with me, we've all been in a state that we feel we're closest to God, okay? Whether it's Holy Friday or Easter Sunday, Pascha, there are times in our lives or whatever time that is, where we feel that we are close to God, even in personal prayer, whatever.
Yeah.
So there is a feeling associated with that. There is a sense that we feel, I don't know how to describe it. Is it peace? Is it joy? Contentment? There is a feeling associated with that when it happens.
Yeah.
So are you saying that that's not it?
No, I think you can have a feeling associated with peace and joy.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't call those feelings.
Oh, okay.
Now their feeling may reflect it. It may go along with it.
Yeah.
One of the most difficult things about Christian growth, and the monastic fathers and mothers talked a lot about this more than others because they really experienced it. They would talk about these three phases of the spiritual life, and I won't get into that in detail now, but the first was it's sort of like you get your start in the church. Illumination is often the word they describe it with. And it's, among other things, it is that excitement, that zeal of a newfound faith.
Right.
But then the next phase is purification, which if you had to give it a quality description, it's not very feeling-centered. It's not strong feeling. In fact, it's often the absence of feeling that marks that, where most people see that as problematic.
Yes.
Some people describe it as a dry spell or a dry season.
Yes.
It's like you're stripped when you're purified. Right. Stripped.
Okay. But in the Christian life, that's a growth from illumination.
Okay.
In other words, if you stick with the initial zeal, you're holding on to something that you need to grow beyond. Not that you leave illumination behind, but the fathers are clear, you bring the best with you, but you got to progress.
Yeah.
So what do we do? And I'll connect this to the modern culture we're in. The modern culture says the more deeply you feel, the more authentic it is.
Yeah.
So watch commercials and see how it's all about deeply connecting with something. And it doesn't matter. It could be a glass of milk. It could be a car. It can be, you know, adult underwear. I mean, whatever brings those warm feelings that says go for that thing.
Yeah.
The spiritual life says, yeah, go, but keep going. Don't stop there. And that's right, the warning about feelings. Because what if your feelings say, I don't feel like going to church?
Yeah.
What's the advice? Go anyway.
Right.
I don't feel like confessing. Go confess anyway. Now, what happens when you do those things, often you get other feelings.
Sure.
Nothing wrong with a feeling. The only thing wrong with it is it becomes the goal. Feeling has effect, nothing wrong. These are God-given response that our body gives us to understanding things. The problem is when we make that the goal, and then if the next step takes us away from the feeling, we often will refrain from that next step. Especially if the next steps are going to be more difficult and perhaps less feeling.
So then you said that that's the second step. And you said there was a third. Is that right?
Yeah. So the third is often called deification. The Greek word is theosis. It's where we we sort of culminate that journey. And it's interesting in the spiritual writings, it's where God acts because we have made the space for him. It's where God shares his reality with us in a more direct way. Why? Because he can. In other words, as we progress in the spiritual life, if God does too much, we become dependent on him doing something for us to do it. And the Father is very clear that the first stage and the third stage, time-wise, tend to be very short. They're not very long. We spend the most of our life, the great majority of our lives, journeying through that second stage.
I would agree.
Which, again, is accompanied by this often feelings of dryness. God seems very distant.
Yeah.
But what the Father says is, yes, he's appearing distant because he's inviting you to, of your own will, keep going. In other words, if I get rewarded for doing something, I'm doing it because I get the reward.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not doing it because of the goodness of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
What God says is, I'm going to reveal myself to you in the way that you need. And for the vast majority of us, that means not very much. Why? Because that's our freedom to say, I'm going to pursue him anyway. I'm going to follow his way, not because he's throwing me little treats along the way. Now, if God wants to reward us, he will. But the bulk of our wisdom, the church says, you're not going to feel that very often. And that's deliberate on God's part. That's him saying, if you're going to do it, you do it out of what we might call sheer will. Not because you're responding to a reward or a sense of fulfillment.
Right.
That's, again, where we get trapped in our own sense of what is helpful or not. What were you going to say, Rick?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, there's so many thoughts that you bring up in my mind, but that, you know, you hear things like, you know, love is a decision.
Yes,
because you know, like love is not always a feeling; it's a decision we make.
Right.
You mean you don't feel love for me all the time?
Never.
Just decide.
Let me ask you a question, Susie. This is a good demonstration.
Yeah.
If Rick feels like taking you out for a nice dinner and buying you flowers, and if he really feels like this, and he does it, that's, we'll call that option A. Option B is he doesn't feel like it. He'd rather go golfing with the guys. He'd rather take a nap. But because he loves you, he goes out and buys you flowers and takes you out for a nice dinner. That's B. In which one is he loving you more?
Well, you would think he's loving me more by going against what he really feels. And doing it anyway.
Why?
Sacrificial.
Yeah. In other words, he's not doing it for the internal reward of when he feels like it. Now, they're both love, but it's a good example of a higher plane of love that doesn't require him to get something out of it. I used to tell the kids at camp, and I was trying to explain, you know, sacrificial love. One of the places I hate to go the most is the mall. The mall drives me crazy. Like, I can handle it for about 12 minutes. And then I'm like, where's the exit, right? Now, there's nothing wrong with the mall. There's nothing inherently evil about it. It's just, it's not the kind of place I want to go. I want to get in and out. I mean, order online, I love it. It's like, okay, it's set. I don't have to go into the store. But sometimes Vicky wants to go shopping.
Right.
Now, out of her love for me, she rarely asks me. But out of my love for her, if an opportunity comes, like if we're out, we're walking through a town, we're in Grand Haven, whatever, I'll say, you want to go in the store. Not because I want to go in the store.
Right.
Because I love her.
Right.
So it is when we're not getting the reward. I think you're right, Susie. It's a higher love because it is sacrificial.
You go into the store, you wait on the sidewalk.
I try to go in. It's better if there's a chair. I'll wander a little bit.
Yeah.
And if I loved her more, I would always wander. I would never look to the chair and I would never go back out to the bench. I'm working on it.
May I ask you, and forgive us if we go off track, but the illumination, the purification, and the theosis. Is this, I'm going to say, widely experienced by those of us who live so much in this world, as opposed, Father, to the monastics who you cite, you know? Is it really possible to attain it in an everyday worldly life that we live in, with all of our obligations, responsibilities?
It's absolutely possible. Is it common? My guess is no. But my guess is it happens more than we think. I might have told you a story before, so forgive me for repeating it. One time I was visiting the monastery in Pennsylvania, and Mother Christophora was talking to a group of people that were visiting. And she said, by the time we went, she said that they are blown over by Orthodox that live in the world. Was that when we were there together? Okay. She said that they, meaning the nuns, are so impressed by Orthodox who aren't monastics. Huh. They say, you people, you rush home from work on a Wednesday night and you get your kids ready, you bring them to church for pre-sanctified liturgy, you bring them home late. That impresses them. So there are things I think that we don't understand, that there are really great efforts that people make in that spiritual effort. They may not recognize it, and that's okay, by the way. We are not to grade ourselves, plot ourselves on the map. That's a very dangerous thing to do. Because you think about it, if you're the one plotting on a map, you're the one saying, I'm here.
Right.
Meaning you're judging.
Right.
And judging is always negative. You can judge in a positive way and say, oh, look how good I'm doing. That's not very helpful at all. So I think there's a lot of really good things happening in the world. We have saints that are of all professions. Saints are every walk of life, rich, poor, you know, married people, not just clergy, you know, certain career people. I'll bring out Egyptian doctors. Egyptian doctors have this tradition of blending their profession with their faith. So for example, you go to a doctor in Egypt, typically what happens is you go into the exam room and there's an icon with a candle lit. And the doctor says a prayer with you. Then he conducts what's a normal modern medical examination.
What the Russian doctor you
mentioned. Oh, yeah. That Russian surgeon, St. Luke.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
And by the way, the nuns prayed for us. Remember, we wrote our names down and they did a prayer list.
Yeah.
That was nice.
So, yeah, I think it happens, you know, is it rare? I think it's still rare. And I think this is the reason why, by the way, I keep talking about this whole feeling thing, is that modern sensibility that elevates feeling works against this process. But because it's becoming so universal in the culture, I think that's where we have to be careful. And, you know, I'll bring up a political example.
Yeah.
China versus the US.
Yeah.
Now, forget the politics and the evil of communism. It is not in Chinese culture to elevate the need for feeling or the prominence of feeling. They're getting infected by it because of Western culture and commerce and all that.
Right.
I read something yesterday. At the turn of this century, China had no high-speed rail. Okay?
Yeah.
By 2008, and I forget the stat, they had thousands of miles of high-speed rail, of trains that go 250 miles an hour.
Yeah.
If you look at what China is doing, again, I'm not commenting on the morality of the government and the persecutions. I'm saying culturally, they're going to advance because in their culture and in their political environment, they're taught, do this for the state, do this for, you know, the people and then all this stuff. They're going to advance. We, as Americans, as Westerners in general, who are buying the, you know, who directs our society, commerce. I'm not against capitalism as an economic system, but I'm saying an economic system that connects with this prominence of satisfy your feelings is weakening us, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's saying, go after and get what you want to do. And that's not a way to strengthen a person, a family, or a society. And I think we're seeing this play out, and who knows what's going to happen in a historical time frame. But it doesn't look good to me unless our society takes a turn from it. And that's why I keep bringing that feeling so much is it's now invaded the religious sphere. The fastest growing churches in America are the ones that engender the most powerful emotional response.
Sure.
And Rick, you and Susie, you guys have seen this in the media. Some of these churches produce their worship like a TV show produces an entertainment show.
No question.
Oh, absolutely.
And what drives it? Emotional response. If it touches my emotions, I'll watch it.
Right.
Doesn't, you know. Anyway, no, I think it's an important discussion because Matthew is going to correct, Jesus in Matthew is going to keep correcting not only the Jews of his day, but he's going to correct us in whatever way we've drifted from what was always going to be the way that God invited his people to travel.
Do we think
nice that, and loud.
I'm trying, big voice. Do we think that these challenges have been there for all generations? Are we for some reason unique?
No.
I think the challenges have maybe been different.
I think it's the same. It's the same problem. I think this is a challenge that's always been there for people who could afford to have that temptation. In other words, if you lived a life either of political power or of wealth, and those were typically the same, that you could afford to be choosy, then that was a temptation. In other words, if you could choose how you spend your time, how you spend your money, where you give your attention. I think the challenge or the temptation always was to fulfill your desires. I think if you look at it historically, a relatively small percentage of the people had that, what we'll call a luxury. Most people lived lives of difficulty where you didn't have a lot of time or money or ability to fulfill your desires. And this is why, again, our parents' generation and before them, they didn't need to know the whys because they were going through life doing what they needed to do. And that was pretty much all they could afford to do.
So maybe the fact that we have the education and the ability to go ask the whys, know the St. John mm-hmm. the Ladder, whatever, yep. We know those things is actually getting enough.
Well, it's not the fact of knowing that. It's knowing it's a teaching being taught in a universe or a culture that says pick and choose. And then the culture says pick what you want because getting what you want is always better. I always use the Starbucks example. You can go to Starbucks and you have whatever 8,000 choices to say, here's exactly what I want. And there is a trap that getting what we want is fulfillment. But Jesus is going to tell us in Matthew, doing what you want is a dead end. Serving yourself as your own God keeps you from the Savior.
Yeah.
And in most people, for most of history, they didn't have a lot of choice of what they were going to do. It was like work, feed, work, get to the shelter. There wasn't the amount of expendable money, time, focus. So it's not so much having the ability to have the education, it's the context in which we have education. Now the question is, how do educated people deal with faith? That's it. It's not that the church has changed or that people have changed individually so much as the culture has changed, especially, I would say, in the modern era in the Western world.
This may be wishful thinking on my part, but, and I'm going to call this internal, just I'm just going to call it faith. Okay, so it seems to me that the people I know that give me hope, that I know see beyond, they saw faith, they were always older. Susie, they were our grandparents, right?
Yeah.
So the people recognized, and by the time we knew them, they were our grandparents. So they're already older. This is where I'm having my hope, right? That yes. As you get older, you have less things. Maybe you are able to see a little better towards the theosis. Some of those people I believe made it. I could see them in church. I know they saw things I wasn't seeing. Mm-hmm. And that gives me the reason to come back because I have hope that I might get there,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the challenge to circle back to our kids is they need to see us looking like we're getting there.
Yes.
They can go to camp and do it with their friends. This is all mm-hmm. lots of fun. But when they're back here, they need to know that there is something that we see.
Yes.
Yes. And that's our challenge, is to be our grandparents to our grandchildren.
Oh, yes. That's so well stated.
Yeah.
That it almost brings a tear to my eye, but that's so true. It
scares me a lot, Susie. I don't know how we get there.
Well, and here's the danger. Our grandparent era is not the same as our grandparent era.
Right.
Right.
That's right. They're right.
The church was their only community.
Our grandparents and my great grandparents. The church was their, they lived the church. That was home, went to work, and then church. Right. That was the community,
right.
Especially of the ethnic people. They stuck together. Right. Who else did they have to rely on?
Right.
Each other.
Yeah.
They were in a new country.
Right. So now we have a world with all these different options, and some of them are very attractive. And so that's the question is, will we choose, because we don't have to choose the church anymore, will we choose it anyway?
It's right. Safer.
But that's our choice.
Yeah.
That's the correct. Choice we're all making today while we sit.
Absolutely.
Now, we may not get everybody to come back. Well,
right.
But if we can try it. And I'm just motivated by those people I know
mm-hmm.
who saw beyond. We don't see them anymore, so right. I gotta hope they're still like there.
Yep.
But yeah. And some of you guys, I'm watching for it, okay?
Listen to you. We all are, I don't really want to name names
mm-mm.
because I don't want to say right. I know the condition of somebody's heart, although I feel I know in right. quotations.
Yeah.
But I think some of our elders who we watched and who are no longer with us
right.
in our church
yep.
had something
absolutely.
So very special. That we experienced it by observing them, as you say.
That's kind of what I'm saying. We're probably all thinking about the same people. We just want to name them, but it's,
right.
it's you know, they're
right.
Many of them.
Right.
Yeah. And it's interesting, and this should give us some hope. They weren't dependent upon either knowledge or feeling or experience. It was their choice. It was their, again, sheer will that we looked at and went, wow. And that's something that we all have available to us. We don't have to learn a certain thing. We don't have to have a certain experience or motivation, whatever. We have to make the choice. Now, again, what Matthew is going to keep saying, which is why this whole conversation, we didn't do one verse today, but it's all been on Matthew. It's all been on Matthew. It is about the heart, and the heart, the most sincere part of the heart, is what we do by the most freedom we have. What we're going to see as this plays out, we saw it in Holy Week. Rick, you mentioned Holy Week.
Yep.
Jesus going to his passion
yep.
out of his own sheer will.
Yes.
And we're going to have this brought out to us in less than 3 months. So the Feast of the Cross was the first feast of the church year, September 14th. Mm-hmm. 40 days before that is August 6th. What feast is August 6th?
Transfiguration.
Okay. So what's one of the main themes of Transfiguration is Jesus is going to show only Peter, James, and John are going to see Jesus reveal himself as he really is. And as our hymns are going to tell us over and over again, it's so that when they would see him crucified, they would know that he was there doing that voluntarily. It was his choice to do that. And so that's where Matthew is going to show us Jesus as the example of this. Jesus will have every motivation to turn aside from the path that he's been called to, but he will never turn aside for a second. And then what is he going to say to all of us? Stick to the path. No matter what you feel, no matter what you know, no matter what someone else is saying to you, stick to the path. Out of sheer will and dedication, which is really love, stick to the path. Well, thank you all. Beautiful discussion on the heart as Matthew talks about it. And then we're going to be ready for it as we see this theme come out. We are not going to be together next week. I will be out of town. And here's a question for us. What do we want to do about scheduling Bible study over summer when a lot of us are going to be coming and going a lot? Do we want to go for a few weeks and take a break? Do we want to go all the way through? What's your sense?
Go all the way through.
Linda says keep going.
Because we're behind now.
Oh, we're never behind.
Well, this was an all-time record. No verse.
We are never behind.
No verse.
We spent an hour and 7 minutes talking about the heart as Jesus teaches it in Matthew.
I have to catch up. There's no time.
There's no more important thing.
Okay, you can skip a couple weeks and then we'll do it.
So we're going to have to skip in July because I'm gone for several weeks in July because of camp.
How about if we finish June and we skip July and come back in August?
That could work.
It'd be awesome if we did it remotely from camp.
Wow, wow.
I'll turn on the camera and you can join Ask Abuna. All right, so I will schedule the 10th and the 17th and the 24th. Of June, and then we'll take a break for July and we'll think about August. Sound good?
All righty.
So no Bible study next week, but then God willing, we'll be back here on the 10th.
Thank you so much, Father.
Thank you all.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Love to everyone.
You too.
Bye.